there, my name is Brian Delaney, and thank you for joining me on a very special episode of Road Safety at Rush Hour, a podcast presented by the Roadway Safety Foundation, a national nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing the frequency and severity of motor vehicle crashes, injuries, and fatalities through improvements to roadway systems and their environment. On this episode, I am so excited to have the opportunity to interview a true national leader in transportation, former United States Secretary of Transportation, the Honorable Mr. Jim Burnley. Secretary Burnley, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to have the chance to be with you.
Thank you. Secretary Burnley, just to give a little bit of an introduction to you, you served as the United States Secretary of Transportation from 1987 to 1989 under the Ronald Reagan administration, and you were one of the nation's leaders in transportation law and policy. And in addition to serving as Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Burnley, you served as Deputy Secretary of Transportation from 1983 to 1987 and was General Counsel of the Department of Transportation in 1983. And then prior to your years at the United States Department of Transportation, Mr. Burnley served as an Associate Deputy Attorney General for the Justice Department and as Director of the VISTA Program in the early 1980s. And currently, Mr. Burnley serves as a partner at Venable LLP with a focus in government relations and regulatory and legislative affairs with a concentration in transportation matters. So, Mr. Burnley, today I want to learn a little bit about you and what it was like to be Secretary of Transportation during your time. And so how did you find your way to transportation? What got you interested in transportation and safety?
Well, I backed into it. I had been at the Justice Department a year as Associate Deputy Attorney General when my fellow North Carolinian Elizabeth Dole was nominated to be Secretary of Transportation right at the very end of 1982. And I knew Mrs. Dole well, and I knew Bob Dole well, primarily because I had been a Republican leader in North Carolina in the 1970s, and Bob Dole's first attempt to run for president was in the 1980 Republican primaries, so I'd gotten to know them in that period. Mm-hmm. She asked me to come over to the department to be general counsel. I did not say then what I'm about to say, but what I knew about transportation was enough to get my driver's license renewed. So I was hired initially to be the chief lawyer for the department, and
sure.
I knew about being a lawyer.
Right, that's right.
As to transportation policy issues, I got dropped in the deep end of the pool, and you either sink or swim, so I swam frantically.
Right.
I was blessed to inherit very good career staff in the general counsel's office who were quite kind to me in educating me intensively. And so I just became general counsel in name and fairly quickly, in fact, by a lot of hard work and study, and then built in terms of my knowledge and interest in transportation policy from there.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's funny that you say that now. You know, enough information to get your driver's license, but you know, it takes a team absolutely to build and create policy and make positive change. And so was there a moment really in your career, at least when you became Deputy Secretary of Transportation, or even when you were Secretary of Transportation, where you realized maybe a passion that existed in the field?
Well, it is impossible to identify a moment, but mm-hmm. from the very beginning of my time at DOT, I was fascinated by the issues, both as to their breadth and their depth. Mm-hmm. I quickly came to understand, and I still believe it to be true today, that there's no other agency or set of agencies in the U.S. government that has as much day-to-day impact on the lives of Americans as does DOT. And when you think about all of the modal administrations there, from right. NHTSA to FHWA to the Federal Transit Administration to the FAA
right.
and several others, again, the breadth and depth of the department's jurisdiction and impact is really difficult to fully comprehend, even mm-hmm. when you're there. So So I did quickly develop a very strong set of interests, not an interest, but a set of interests in the diverse issues. And a few months after I became general counsel, the Supreme Court, at the very end of its spring term, in other words, in mid to late June, mm-hmm. Issued a decision in a case that was pending when both Elizabeth Dole became secretary and when I became general counsel, known as the State Farm case. And that is a case which basically required us to, within fairly narrow boundaries that the Supreme Court set, to reconsider the whole question of airbags in automobiles. The Carter administration had put out a rule that was to be phased in, and the first Secretary of Transportation under President Reagan, Secretary Drew Lewis, and his team had rescinded that rule. So it was the appeal from their decision to rescind the rule that the Supreme Court handed down. The Supreme Court said they did not have sufficient grounds for rescinding it and told us to redo it, again, within some fairly strict guidelines. And so that became a very, very important, significant project from the summer of 83 until we issued a decision in the summer of 84. And I'm very proud of the outcome of that because it not only resulted in public acceptance over time of airbags, and today nobody would want to buy a car without a half dozen airbags on it, but it also encouraged the states, not required the states, but it encouraged the states to pass seatbelt laws. And the combination of those two over the ensuing decades has been dramatic in saving lives and reducing injuries by the many hundreds of thousands.
Wow. That's incredible. It's amazing to think about how decisions that you were able to be such a huge, an instrumental part in has contributed so greatly towards reduced fatalities and safety for all Americans today. I mean, we think, you know, years later, the impacts, I can't picture a world or a car where I didn't have an airbag, you know, and throughout my entire life, and how important those are and life-saving measures. You know, I'm familiar with family members and friends who've been involved in car crashes that their lives are saved because of airbags. And it's thanks.
Well, that's happened to me twice personally since the early 80s. In fact, in the last decade, I've walked away from accidents twice where, but for the airbags, I might not be here today. And the other amazing fact is that in 1983, when I arrived to the department, reliable surveys showed that less than 20% of Americans even fastened their seatbelts. Because, again, of the way in which we address the issues by encouraging states to pass seatbelt laws, that number jumped very dramatically. By the early 90s. It was in the upper 80 to low 90% range. And the last figures I saw some time ago, it was above 90%.
Right.
So it's a combination of the airbag requirement plus the seatbelt laws that have gotten us some very dramatic outcomes over time.
When you were secretary, what went through your mind or what were you thinking? Like, what was your thought process with regards to like seatbelts and airbags? Obviously now they're very much a publicly accepted tool for keeping individuals safe, and all cars have seatbelts, all cars have airbags. How has that changed? What was your mindset, and how do you reflect on that now?
Well, I became secretary in 1987, so at that point it had been 3 years since we had put the rule out. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but basically the way we structured the rule, it said unless most states pass seatbelt laws that are effective within a three-year period, the automobile industry will then have to start phasing in the airbags. And so when I became secretary, we were right at that sort of break point. It turned out that the states had virtually all passed seatbelt laws by then, but we had set some very simple criteria to make sure the laws were effective. And certain very cynical interest lobbied state by state to make sure of our half dozen sort of basic requirements to make sure a seatbelt law was effective, that each state law did not satisfy all six of them. So we couldn't count them. And that then meant the automobile industry had to phase in the airbags. That was not the result we anticipated. We thought it would be one or the other. We ended up getting both. And so when I was secretary, we were at that point where we declared the automobile industry's got to go forward. They have to have lead time, as you know, to design new models, design equipment, particularly airbags, design them in the car. Absolutely. The first time is a big deal.
Right, yes.
And so we were in the early years of the automobile industry beginning to include airbags in my time as secretary.
That's such a monumental shift and positive change in automobile manufacturing today that we look back on now.
Nobody today would even think about buying a car without
exactly
4, 5, or 6 airbags on it.
Yes. So.
Now, I want to take a quick step back and talk a little bit about either the day or maybe a series of days when you were approached to be the United States Secretary of Transportation. It's a great honor, and you were nominated, if I'm correct, at the young age of 39 years old. What went through your mind when, you know, President Reagan reached out to you and offered this position? What happened? Sort of what was that day or that scenario?
Well, I was very surprised because I had known that Secretary Dole was going to resign to go help Bob Dole run for president the second time,
sure.
Of the three times he ran in 88. And so I knew she was leaving, and I had no expectation of succeeding her. So I was beginning to consider my own alternatives personally, because there's no rule to it, but more often than not, a new secretary comes in and wants his or her own choice as deputy secretary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is the number two job. It's like the chief operating officer job in a major, major company.
Absolutely.
So you usually want somebody that you know and have confidence in that job. So I figured whoever comes next, you know, I'm probably going to hit the street. And I was beginning to seriously consider options. Got a call pretty much out of the blue from President Reagan's chief of staff, who was former Senator Howard Baker at that time, asking if I was interested in succeeding Secretary Dole, and I didn't have to think about that more than about a nanosecond.
Right, yeah.
And so we went from there.
Wow, that's amazing. And did you have a lot of interaction with President Reagan? What was it like working with the President of the United States?
I had a fair amount of interaction with him, and Secretaries of Transportation don't typically fly a lot on Air Force One. That tends to be more the Secretary of State or perhaps the Secretary of Defense.
Sure.
But I did have the wonderful opportunity in the spring of 88 to fly with him on Air Force One to Connecticut, because at that point he had addressed commencement gatherings at all of the service academies except the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And the Coast Guard was still in DOT at that time, where I personally believe it should be today, but it was moved to DHS when DHS was created.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have the chance to travel with him, and he did a wonderful job, as you would expect. He was such a gifted speaker. Hartford is about 30 miles, 25 miles from New London. So,
right, yes.
So we had to land in Hartford and then drive in the motorcade to and from. So I had a lot of fun on that trip.
Yes.
And the opportunity to really just have some very sort of informal time with him versus being in a meeting in the Oval Office, which I did too on a number of occasions, or in a cabinet meeting, which of course occurred a number of times. So he was a remarkable president in so many ways, was the same person in private that you saw in public, basically. I mean, yes, he was a professional actor, and he used those skills his great political benefit, and I think it's one of the reasons he was such a gifted leader. But that really wasn't an act. What you saw in public was pretty much what you saw in private with Ronald Reagan.
Wow.
And Secretary Burnley, as a leader of the United States Department of Transportation, and then also a leader throughout your entire career within the field of transportation, what advice or insight would you give regarding leadership?
There are two things that come to mind in answer to your question. One is that you do, particularly in a department as huge as DOT, I mean, when I was there, it had 100,000 people on the payroll.
That's incredible.
So you have to learn to delegate. And you have to make choices about what you delegate. But on the major issues where you delegate, you also have to retain accountability. And if you don't delegate and try to micromanage everything, it's probably not going to turn out well. And similarly, if you delegate without accountability, you're likely to have things go wrong. So it's striking that balance. A big part of that is deciding what issues a secretary should be involved in and what issues others, leaders, can handle in an organization that size. So I think that's an extremely important lesson. The other thing is that you need to be available to the press. The press plays a vital role in both conveying information, but also asking questions about process within a big agency like DOT that people are entitled to know about. But if you cannot maintain confidences among the senior leadership, if the secretary has a meeting and the next day somewhere in the transportation press or the general press, that meeting, which was a strictly internal meeting, when you're in the middle of making policy decisions, if that's suddenly reported in the press and reported in a distorted way, which would often be the case if that happened, then that sort of undermines the whole decision-making leadership process. So it's really important as a leader to set an example and to make sure everybody around you understands that the deliberations of the leadership of an organization like this do need to be confidential. People do need to be comfortable in batting ideas around. They do need to be comfortable in raising skeptical questions. That's really critical. And all that can be chilled if everything is going to be regurgitated, again, often in a distorted way in the media. So those are the two areas where I think an effective leader in an organization like that needs to be very focused in making those two dynamics work properly.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's very interesting. I love the idea of accountability and transparency among your employees when you're working in an organization to be able to foster an environment that is open and comfortable for innovation and collaboration. And I think in any agency, any organization, that's important. It's very
important.
And we
benefited enormously from the fact that we had no idea what texting was and email was in its earliest, most rudimentary stage. So we didn't have to worry about what was going to be retransmitted
right. Instantly.
We were better off in terms of preserving the confidentiality to have those kinds of candid conversations. We didn't have to worry about either of those.
And going on to that, we obviously communication and even how mobility has changed in our society is quite drastic from the time that you were secretary to where we are now. And in many ways, I think a lot of the issues that you faced as Secretary of Transportation when it comes to roadway safety and infrastructure and transportation are probably very similar to what they are today. How has mobility in our country changed and also remained the same since you were secretary?
Well, I think the similarities are greater than the differences, but the differences are significant. I mean, automobiles are still the primary means of transportation for most Americans over any significant distance. That has certainly not changed. There are lots of experiments going on with encouraging the use of bicycles and scooters, and I haven't seen skateboards recently, but that may be next. And yet, when it comes right down to it, the automobile still is the primary means of going any significant distance for most Americans. That is an area where, as you know, we are seeing all kinds of experimentation with new technologies that I believe will lead us to autonomous vehicles someday in the not too distant future. Mm-hmm. But we're still in the first stages of sorting out what the government's policy should be on both the federal and the state and even the local level as those vehicles do mature, the technology matures, and then they become ubiquitous. And then, the other thing that's very exciting, but again, it's on the horizon, it's not happening present tense quite yet, will be the communications between the vehicles and the roads. And right. By that I mean the signalization on the roads, and then perhaps even vehicle to vehicle. And as you know, there's a robust debate right now about the spectrum, and DOT and the FCC are at odds about that. I'm glad to see DOT sticking up for what it believes to be the spectrum it will need for that kind of technology to take off. So that kind of dynamism and experimentation is different, very different from the late 80s. I mean, again, we were focused on airbags are going to be phased into cars over the next 3 years. And then as now, people kept their cars 10 or 11 years on average, so it takes a decade for new technologies to really become ubiquitous. And so that's very different. But we still have the underlying safety issues. Fatalities in my era hovered in the mid 40,000 range. We have a much bigger population today, and they now hover in the mid 30,000 range. But unfortunately, the last couple of years, while they've leveled off, we went through several years before that where fatalities were increasing because they really bottomed out around 30,000, 31,000. I don't recall the exact number, just a few years ago. And while the data is not absolutely definitive, there is certainly a striking coincidence between the universal adoption of cell phones by virtually everybody who drives and fatalities and injuries heading back up before they hit the current plateau. So that creates a whole new dimension of safety challenges for leaders at all levels. And I don't know what the answers are there. I really don't. And I don't know anyone who I believe has figured out the answers to that, but it's a very, very important set of issues.
What would you consider to be your biggest victories or accomplishments in the realms of road safety and highway transportation safety that during your time as Secretary of Transportation? I know that's a big question.
I have a quick answer, though. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of the fact that I am the father of the regulations across the transportation modes that require drug testing. Pre-employment drug testing, random drug testing, post-accident drug testing when there are significant injuries or fatalities. And I'm responsible for putting out the rules in the fall of 1988 that required that in the aviation industry, the trucking industry, the bus industry, and the railroad industry. We were not able to do anything with alcohol testing because the testing regimes just weren't sophisticated enough, and alcohol, as you know, dissipates fairly quickly from the system. So we did focus on drugs, and we were seeing anecdotally increasing evidence that drugs were a significant problem. Not everyone in transportation or even in the Reagan administration agreed with me on this. And I had a pretty serious battle inside the Reagan administration. But President Reagan had, from the beginning of his presidency, been very focused on addressing drug issues and had taken a number of initiatives. And so ultimately, it was not hard to convince him that this was a very good and important step forward. So we were able to get those regulations promulgated right at the end of his administration and my tenure as secretary. And I think they've long since been accepted by all the industries. And I think today if somebody proposed repealing those, they would be very quickly dismissed out of hand by the decision makers. So I'm particularly proud of having seen that exercise through from start to finish.
I have one last final question before we conclude the podcast. And I like to ask this question to all of my guests. And particularly, I'm very curious to hear your perspective. What does the future look like for road safety and infrastructure? There's the movement towards zero, and the only acceptable number of fatalities and crashes is zero. With zero transportation fatalities as our goal, what needs to happen going forward?
Well, I think we're fundamentally on the right path. I think it is a good thing that neither the federal government nor most of the states have put rigid rules into place concerning autonomous vehicles and experiments with those vehicles. And there's a elusive perfect balance between making sure that those experimenting do not cause accidents and cause serious injuries and fatalities if something goes amiss, and on the other hand, making it possible for them to experiment. And ultimately, with these systems, you've got to have real-world road conditions, and you've got to see how the technology does not work in real-world road conditions. So permitting experimentation where they always have a driver under the wheel to take control may not be perfect in the eyes of some, but I think it's by far the best situation. And I was very pleased to see Secretary Chao's announcement last week about updating the approach of DOT and how they're handling autonomous vehicle issues. Because again, I think she tried and was successful in striking the proper balance to make sure that while we emphasize safety, we do give people the flexibility to experiment. That will ultimately get us closer to zero than anything else. If those experiments lead to, in 10 years, most of the vehicles on our roads being autonomous and communicating with each other as well as I said earlier, the signalization, that's how we approach zero.
Thank you. You know, it is not every day that you have the opportunity to sit down with a former secretary, cabinet secretary, and discuss transportation. Especially, I just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation and to talk, give a little behind the scenes of what it was like to work as Secretary of Transportation and under the Reagan administration, and also contributing so many great insights into transportation, the issues that exist today, and some of those issues that existed during your time as Transportation Secretary. So Secretary Burnley, thank you so much for taking the time to have a conversation with me and to be on the Road Safety at Rush Hour podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. So in closing, on behalf of the Roadway Safety Foundation, I would like to thank everyone for tuning in to this podcast episode of Road Safety at Rush Hour. If you enjoyed the podcast and want to hear more, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter at the Roadway Safety Foundation and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast network. As always, this is Brian Delaney signing off, wishing you safe travels all day and every day.